So I'm going to talk about two recent papers I wrote, the first with Adam Brown, who I guess is also visiting, and also the second with Adam Brown and Alim Assoumi. And the idea is going to be to study a very... It's trying to sign onto Wi-Fi. Let me... Do you guys do any edits on the tapes you make of talks? Or all this is in? Okay, we'll see how far we get this time. The idea is to start with a very, very simple higher dimensional action and look at the compactified vacua we get. So for this talk, this will be the action that we're looking at. It's only got three terms. The first is an Einstein-Maxwell term, so we have dynamical higher dimensional gravity. The second is a Q-form flux. And the third is a hard cosmological constant in D dimensions that will take to either be plus or negative, mostly plus, though. And in particular, we'll look at compactifications of this form. So we'll take the internal manifold to be a product of n Q-spheres. This cartoon here is a doodle of what that looks like for n equals 1. So at each point in the higher dimensional space, there's a Q-sphere that sits, and it's tiny, and it's wrapped up with flux. Now, we're not the first people to have come up with the idea of studying a simple model in order to learn general lessons. In particular, there are two previous models of sort of simple models of higher dimensional compactifications that have received a lot of study. The first is the Busa-Polchinski model. And there, the internal manifold has many internal Q cycles, but the extra dimensions are held fixed by fiat, so they're non-dynamical. And the other model that's received a lot of attention is the n equals 1 von Drüben model. So that's the case where the internal manifold is a single Q-sphere. So in that case, there's only a single internal cycle, but the extra dimensions are dynamical. And in some sense, the thing I'm going to talk about today is the third simplest thing you can do. It combines these two features. So we'll have an internal manifold that's a product of n Q-spheres, meaning that there's a large number of internal cycles, and also the extra dimensions are dynamical. And by combining these two features, we'll see that a number of new phenomena arise in this landscape. And in particular, one phenomenon we'll find is the existence of a double exponentially large number of compactified de Sitter vacua, whose cosmological constants accumulate at lambda 4 equals 0.
Sorry, you said the Q is sphere. What is Q?
Oh, it's just the dimension of the sphere.
Yeah, but can it be anything?
Yeah, it can be anything. What, like 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that. An integer.
So we have
a positive non-zero integer. And it needs to be bigger than 1 so that you have a curvature term.
I see. So our space is four large dimensions cross this SQ.
That's right. So we'll try to keep things general. We'll start with a D that's large and compactify down on n Q spheres. So the number of large dimensions is D minus n Q, which you might want to set equal to 4. And we'll start with D however big we want. Okay, so this is the outline of the talk. We'll be in three parts. First, I'll go over the previous models a little more slowly. Then I'll talk about the distribution of cosmological constants in the compactified vacua of this general n von Drüben model. And for that part, I'll treat the radii of the spheres as dynamical, but I'll hold the shapes fixed. And then in part three, we'll go and we'll fix that problem, and we'll look at what happens when you also vary the shapes of the spheres. Okay. So let's start with the Busa-Polchinski model. The idea here is that you have a bare cosmological constant, lambda no flux, and then it's shifted up by fluxes that wrap the internal Q cycles. So you'll have many internal Q cycles, which means you have many different Ni, that's the number of units of flux around each cycle. And the Ni are quantized because they're wrapping a compact cycle. So you can imagine vacua living at discrete grid points in in this model. So here, this is, for instance, the N1 and N2 axes. And vacua live at discrete points where N1 and N2 are integer here.
So these fluxes are Q-forms, or?
They're Q-forms, yeah. So equipotentials are circles or spheres. They're circles if all of the GI are equal. So this guy in the middle where there's no flux around any cycle is lambda, I guess, I'm sorry, that should say lambda no flux. So if all of the Ni are zero, the vacuum has its bare cosmological constant. And then here are the equipotential surfaces. They're circles of increasing radius. And if you take the bare cosmological constant to be negative, then this landscape will have some ADS vacua and some de Sitter vacua. So there'll be some guy in the middle that corresponds to lambda 4 equals 0, and there'll be some regime around it that's habitable. So those are low de Sitter vacua. There should, but we'll take the size of the extra dimension to be big enough that flux is just dominating. Flux is giving a classical contribution, so it'll dominate at larger radii. But there should be back reaction of the flux on the internal manifold, and we're holding the size and shape of the extra dimensions completely fixed. So the only term we're counting here is flux. So in particular, there's some sphere of larger radius that corresponds to the place where the energy density becomes Planckian. And all of these vacua out here have lambda 4 super Planckian. So the effective theory that we're plugging into is breaking down, and we shouldn't count vacua outside this circle. So in particular, that means the Busel-Polchinski model gives rise to a finite total number of vacua, of which a order one fraction are anti-de Sitter, and an order one fraction are de Sitter.
What is the order one fraction? It looks like the ones that are outside are more than the ones inside.
No, that's true. I just mean a finite total number of de Sitter vacua and a finite number of anti-de Sitter vacua. So you can put these vacua on a histogram. So we can plot the number density of vacua with each value of lambda 4. And it looks like this. And there are two features here to notice. The first is that it's smooth through lambda 4 equals 0. The landscape has no special features there. And indeed, that has to be the case. If you hold fixed the size and shape of the extra dimensions, then it's just non-gravitational physics that's setting the value of the cosmological constant. And non-gravitational physics doesn't know anything about specific values of the energy. It only knows about energy differences. So you can't expect any features here. And indeed, there aren't any. There is, however, this. Okay, it's that's right. When you take the number of cycles to be large, when you take the number of n to be large, the number of cycles, so the number of directions in this landscape to be large, then you expect points to lie exponentially close to each equipotential. So it's smooth on all but exponentially small scales. If you go to very small scales, indeed, this histogram is actually made up of a sum of delta functions.
Well, then, but we are interested in very small scales.
Right, but so, right. So you could.
So the smoothness is irrelevant.
You could.
We're interested in the neighborhood of zero.
Even in the neighborhood of zero, I'd say it's still when you can take n large enough that it becomes effectively smooth there. The capital N, the number of different cycles. So here, this is shown for n equals 2. There are just two flux directions. But if you have other flux directions,
so
I mean.
Do you want to take the number of cycles to be exponentially large?
Yes. Yeah, that's the Busel-Polchinski model. That's right. That's what they take.
So is this the number of directions in your multidimensional space?
That's right.
Well, 10 to the 100.
Sorry, this talk, you walked in after the introduction, but I'm not mostly going to be talking about the Busel-Polchinski model. I'm not here to defend this. But they take n to be very large, in which case the spacing becomes very small between the vacua.
But you don't want to defend that.
So if you go to exponentially fine scales, e to the minus n, you'll notice that this histogram is made up of.
How many scales we're interested in?
But I mean, even if it is jagged, I don't think it makes much of a difference. And the question is, how large would we are to be
huge?
Huge.
You can definitely get it so that it looks effectively smooth on a scale of order the thickness of the habitable zone, though, by taking n large. Okay. Also, because n is large and most of the volume of an n sphere lives very close to the surface area, almost all of the vacua will live up here in this model. So almost all of the vacua have an energy density that's just sub-Planckian. Okay, so that's one previous model that people have studied. The other model that has been studied is the n equals 1 Freund-Rubin model. So here you'll take d dimensions and you compactify down on a single q-sphere. So at every point in space, there's a single q-sphere wrapped up by q-form flux. The higher dimensional action is the same as the one we put up before, but we'll look at compactification specifically of this form with just a single Q-sphere. And you put in this metric ansatz. So the metric ansatz has a smooth d minus Q dimensional large spacetime dimensions and an internal sphere whose radius is r. And you also pull off this Weyl factor, 1 over r to the Q, that looks like the volume of the internal manifold. And pulling off this, this Weyl factor means that when you plug this metric ansatz into the action and integrate over the internal Q-sphere, that you end up in Einstein frame. So this is the effective action you get after following those steps. You get d minus Q dimensional gravity, and you get a scalar field R with some kinetic term, and it lives in an effective potential Vf. And this is the effective potential for the R field. It's got three terms in it. It's got a flux term from the flux that wraps the internal sphere. It's got a curvature term, and it's got a contribution from the cosmological constant. So let's plot that sucker. The flux term is important at the smallest values of r, and it is a repulsive term. It wants to buttress the sphere out and hold r to larger values. The idea there is that flux lines repel one another. So increasing the radius of the sphere allows the flux lines to relax away from each other. The curvature term is attractive and operates in the medium regime here for medium values of r. And the contribution of the flux term and the curvature term gives rise to a minimum of the effective potential. And then at largest values of r, the cosmological constant term is important. And it tells r that it should swell under the pressure of inflation. So here, the solution where r is rolling out this way is cosmological constant dominated evolution. The number of flux units you wrap around the internal sphere is quantized but variable. So we can plot this effective potential for various values of n. When n is small, the minimum is ADS, and it has a tiny radius. As you increase n, the solution moves up to larger values of V effective, and it also moves out to larger values of R. If you increase N too much, though, the minimum completely disappears, and the potential becomes monotonically decreasing. So we can put the vacua of this theory on a phase diagram that looks like this. The vacua are specified by the value of N, and n has to lie in a region between 0 and this value where the catastrophe happens, where the minimum annihilates with the maximum and disappears, and there are no more vacua. So for each integer value of n in this regime, you have a vacuum with a given value of v min. And at some point, it crosses through Minkowski. So in particular, there'll be a finite number of ADS vacua and a finite number of de Sitter vacua. This last guy, this highest.
Can I just ask in principle, why
are
you interested in the vacuum?
So those are the ones that are perturbatively stable.
But there are all kinds of other dynamical solutions. Why do you care about which ones are static?
That's right. So Our motivation here is to just look at what happens when you compactify higher dimensions. So take a really simple model and look at the simplest dynamics we can study. So I think the first thing you want to study is the vacua. And then we can talk about what happens when you heat these vacua up or when they start to tunnel.
You don't have to heat them up. They would be dynamical solutions.
That's right. But there are also static dynamical solutions. And those are the easiest ones to find.
Why do you prefer to study the static solutions
rather than the dynamical solutions? So if our universe has extra dimensions, they're likely, I mean, because our universe has very static, well-understood, low-energy physics, they're likely bound up in a minimum of an effective potential.
So you're interested in this for late times?
I am just interested in how you can hide extra dimensions. And this is one way to hide them. The catastrophe happens at some critical value of n where the minimum of the effective potential disappears. And it happens when the internal radius of the Q-sphere is exactly the Hubble radius, the Hubble length of the higher dimensions. So as you increase n, the minimum is moving out to larger values of r. And at some point, the minimum reaches the Hubble scale of the d-dimensional de Sitter space. And then there are no solutions for larger internal spheres. For larger internal spheres, you have a region where the potential is smooth. That's one Hubble length large. So it gets caught up in the Hubble flow and decompactifies. So this highest vacuum in the landscape has r, has its radius roughly equal to hd. And it also has its Hubble scale. The d minus q dimensional Hubble scale is roughly equal to the d dimensional Hubble scale. So for these de Sitter vacua, all of the physics is just set by hd. Again, we can make a histogram of these vacua. So we can plot the number density of vacua for each value of d minus q. Here, to treat this as smooth, you have to take g to be very small. You have to take the spacing between the vacua to be very small.
That's the gauge coupling?
That's the magnetic flux quantum. So it's setting the spacing between the vacua. There's a finite number of ADS vacua and a finite number of de Sitter vacua, and the distribution through lambda d minus q is smooth. And it comes and it cuts off exactly at the point where the d minus q dimensional Hubble scale is equal to the d dimensional Hubble scale. And the total number of vacua you get goes like an inverse power of the d dimensional Hubble scale. That's because the thing that's setting where the vacua cut off is the point at which you become cosmological constant dominated. So the smaller lambda d is, the more total vacua you get in your landscape. OK, so what happens when you lower lambda d through 0? So we just looked at the case where lambda d is positive. If lambda d is equal to 0, then there's no cosmological constant term that dominates at large r. You take the part where the potential lifts up, and you pull that part off to infinity. So the effective potential is just set by these two terms. It balances the flux term against the curvature term, and it forms a minimum. And there's a minimum of the effective potential for every value of n. The minimum just shifts up to larger values of v, and it shifts out to larger values of r, but it continues indefinitely. There's no n at which it cuts off. So if lambda d is 0, you then have an infinite number of vacua, and their cosmological constants pile up at v equals 0, at lambda equals 0. You have an infinite number of ADS vacua and no de Sitter vacua whatsoever. And recall, in the Busa-Polchinski model, there was a cutoff in n. N couldn't get larger than some value because the effective energy density became super Planckian or stringy or something. The effective field theory broke down. But that's not the case here. So here, actually, as you increase n, the energy density on your solution is going down. The reason is increasing n, obviously, you add a flux unit around the sphere, but the solution also moves out to larger values of r. And it turns out that more than compensates for the increased number of flux units. So as you go out to these solutions here that are just very weakly compactified, that have a large value of r, the flux density on those spheres is very small. So the energy density in flux and the energy density in curvature are both going to zero for these solutions out here.
So could you quickly rewind, what was the difference between Bousso-Polchinski and this point Rubin?
So here are the the extra dimensions are dynamical. They're responding to the addition of flux.
Okay.
When you add more flux, we're shifting out to larger values of R. And that's the thing that's making it.
Can you remind us what the origin of lambda D was in the high-dimensional picture?
So we're just starting with lambda D positive.
In high dimension.
That's right.
Why does it end up behaving like a cosmological constant?
What are you saying? So we're just starting with the higher dimensional action where you have a positive cosmological constant.
That's
so here's our higher dimensional action. Three terms, and one of them is a lambda d.
But it picks up some powers of R. Like
it picks up some powers of R from this Weyl transform.
Mm-hmm.
The Weyl transform puts you in Einstein frame, and it also puts this factor of 1 over the volume in front of the effective potential.
So you don't really have a lambda.
That's true. That's the lower dimensional way of looking at it.
Right.
But it also is consistent with a higher dimensional lambda. So for instance, if you plot the effective potential when n is equal to 0,
yeah.
there won't be the flux term that picks it up at small r. So the effective potential looks like this. And there's a solution where you start here at some value of r and just roll down.
It's quite steep too, right? Big exponent.
There's a solution where you're rolling down this potential, so the internal radius is getting bigger and bigger, and that corresponds exactly to d-dimensional De Sitter space. So here's the throat of De Sitter, and it's growing this way.
Right. The whole thing is
deep. Yeah. So from the lower dimensional picture, it looks like you have a sloping potential, but it's all consistent with a higher dimensional cosmological constant. Okay, so now let's leave these previous models. So these previous models have contributed to a common lore that you see in the literature. And the common lore is that the distribution of De Sitter vacua is always smooth through V4 equals 0. So that was a feature that we saw of these two models. With the exception that you sometimes have these supersymmetric, like ADS5 cross S5 solutions, where the S5 has blown up to be very, very large. So those are the guys we saw here. When lambda was negative, I don't know, I've lost it. Here, when lambda is equal to 0 or negative, you have a pileup of ADS vacua, but no De Sitter vacua. So the common lore is that De Sitter vacua are smooth through V equals 0, and then you might have a pileup of ADS vacua. But I'm here to tell you that that's not the case. To the contrary, if you compactify on a product manifold, so if you move to one greater step of complexity in these models, then the distribution of De Sitter vacua is actually very strongly peaked at V4 equals 0. So we'll get a distribution of vacua that looks like this, with a giant pileup. So in particular, lambda equals 0 is a very special place in this landscape.
What's capital N?
Capital N is the number of internal Q cycles. So it'll be the number of Q spheres that we've compactified on. We're looking at compactifications of the form. So we just studied the N equals 1 case. Okay, so the easiest way to understand how this pileup of vacua is coming about is by analogy with biological natural selection. So natural selection enhances the population of traits that have two characteristics. They need to increase fitness, which is measured by the number of offspring that you give rise to. And second, the trait needs to be heritable, which means that your progeny inherit the trait from you. And we'll see that being a low De Sitter vacuum has these two traits. And you need to think of offspring number, a generation number, as n in this. So compactifications with n equals 1, you can think of as a parent compactification. You have some solution that's ds, d minus q cross sq. And then you take that vacuum, and you compactify on an additional sq. And you can think about that as the progeny that have ensued from this original vacuum. So let's first see why low De Sitter is a trait that you would want to naturally select for. So first, we need to see that it increases the fitness. So remember that the number of offspring was inversely proportional to the parent's Hubble. The argument being lambda d is setting the value of n where the solutions stop existing and start decompactifying.
So I guess I'm a bit troubled by your terminology. Even more problem. but so you start, the idea is that you want to build n equal to 2 space-times from n equal to 1 space-time?
That's right. We'll take an n equals 1 space-time and we'll compactify on an additional SQ.
Okay. And then you want to see basically what's the most likely one n equal to 2 that comes out.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Exactly. So in this sense, because they give rise to more offspring, low De Sitter vacua are fitter. Because their number density, their total number of De Sitter vacua you get is inversely proportional to the parent's Hubble. And the other thing we need to see is that being a low De Sitter is a heritable trait. So remember that the Hubble constant, the lower dimensional Hubble constant, is cut off by the parent's Hubble constant. So if you start with a low De Sitter vacuum, you'll get a distribution of vacua, but they'll all also be low De Sitter. Low De Sitter is a heritable trait. Okay, so let's see how this works. At the n equals 1 level, you have a distribution of vacua that's smooth through lambda equals 0 and that cuts off at some value. And each one of the vacua in this distribution will now give rise to its own set of progeny. So in particular, if you take some vacuum in the middle of this distribution, he'll give rise to his own set of n equals 2 vacua, and the distribution will look the same as the n equals 1 distribution. If you ask about a vacuum with higher value of Hubble constant, he'll also give rise to a distribution of vacua. It cuts off at a larger value of HD because he's starting with a higher HD, but he has a lower total number of offspring, which means that the total area under this curve is smaller for that guy than for this guy. And finally, if you start with a low De Sitter guy, no, so the cutoff is coming from decompactification. It's coming from when the offspring's HD is equal to, your offspring's R is equal to the parent's HD, to the minus 1. So this low De Sitter guy will also give rise to a distribution, and it'll cut off at some smaller value, but the area under this curve is larger because it gives rise to a larger total number of vacua. So you're just going to sum up these distributions, and you get a distribution that looks like this, a distribution that's strongly peaked around HD equals 0. So we can do this with some numbers and compute the distribution of p-dimensional Hubble constants, so where p is equal to d minus nq, after n generations. And it looks like this. It blows up in HP, and the degree of the divergence goes like n minus 1 times q minus 1. So in particular, when n minus 1 times q minus 1 is equal to 2 or bigger, you have an infinite number of De Sitter vacua in this landscape. So for instance, when n equals 2 and q equals 2, that's sort of the smallest thing you could do, you'll have a divergence of vacua, but only a finite total number of De Sitter vacua, because the degree of the divergence is integrable. But when n is equal to 2 or q is equal to 3, or when n is equal to 3 and q is equal to 2, that or any larger values of n, you have an infinite number of De Sitter vacua, according to this argument. So we can see this, we can maybe ditch the flimsy natural selection analogy and see this a little more clearly by looking at an effective potential. So here's just another take on where this pileup of De Sitter vacua is coming from. So we start with a higher dimensional action, and let's look at the n equals 2 effective potential. So we do the same thing, the same steps we did before. We treat the radii of the two internal Q spheres as dynamic, and we integrate over both of them. And this is the effective potential you end up with. You have 1 over the total volume sitting outside. You have 2 repulsive terms that hold both of the r's from going to 0. You have 2 curvature terms that are sucking them out towards 0. And you have a cosmological constant term that's dominating at large values of r. So here's a plot of what the effective potential looks like for some value of n1 and n2. And it's giving rise to an ADS minimum in this case. For each value of N1 and N2, you get an effective potential. You can find the value of the minimum. And you can plot equipotentials. So they look like this. Here, for each value of N1 and N2, you have a minimum. And these black lines connect minima with equal values of lambda. So this blue guy here, this infinitely long blue line that asymptotes these dotted ones, corresponds to Minkowski vacua. All values of N1 and N2 that lie on that line give rise to a minimum for which the effective potential is equal to 0. If you're below this blue line, you give rise to an ADS minimum. And all of these equipotentials are infinitely long as well, and they go off and they asymptote the axes. There's also this green line. The green line is the catastrophe line. That's the point where you've increased the flux too much, and the solution starts to decompactify. So there are no solutions larger than this green line. And in between the green and the blue lines, in this crescent here, are our De Sitter vacua.
Can you show us the potential again, please?
Sure.
So why? So the plot you're showing on the next slide, you're fixing everything in your varying N1 and N2.
And then you're computing the minimum, and we're plotting the value of V in the minimum. So those are equipotentials of V in the minimum.
So you're letting the R's adjust to find the minimum for different values of N1 and N2.
That's right.
So my question was going to be, well, I was expecting circles rather than hyperbola. And so the hyperbola, the reason you're getting hyperbola for fixed V,
yeah,
is because the R's are adjusting again?
That's right. It has to do with the fact that the R's are adjusting. So we can understand why you're getting hyperbola from this sequential compactification argument. These dotted lines exist at the point where at the N equals 1 compactification, so if we'd only gone down one level, the dotted line corresponds to the place where you switch from an ADS vacuum to a DS vacuum. So you can think about these guys where N1 is radically different from N2 sequentially. So when N1 is very different from N2, the solutions have R1 much smaller than R2. So you can imagine first compactifying on R1, and then when you compactify on R2, there's very, very little back reaction, because it just exists at a much larger scale. And then there's a crucial difference whether your N equals 1, your first compactification puts you in ADS or DS. If your first compactification gives you lambda is negative, then you can increase N as far as you want, and you only ever get an ADS vacuum. On the other hand, if your first compactification gives you a De Sitter vacuum, then as you increase N, you should move from ADS to Minkowski to the catastrophe, and then there should be no solutions. So that's why this dotted line is important. And you can also see that the lower De Sitter you are, the more total vacua you have, there's a much longer length before you hit the green line, and also the more De Sitter vacua you have. There's a longer distance between blue and green lines. So this plot was done for the N equals 2, Q equals 2 case, where we saw that there was a pileup of De Sitter vacua, but a finite total number. The degree of the divergence was integrable. And that finite total number is reflected in the fact that there is a finite area between the green and blue lines here. So a finite area of this plot corresponds to De Sitter vacua. If you go to larger n's, then there'll be more dimensions to this phase diagram.
I'm confused. So why is the green that doesn't lie on the black line?
Oh, so the black line here is a De Sitter equipotential. So the De Sitter equipotentials are finite in length, and they end on this green catastrophe line. The green line is where you've put so many units of flux around one of the spheres that it starts to decompactify, that its radius gets bigger than either the D minus Q dimensional Hubble length or the D dimensional Hubble length.
So this pileup at small plus of is mainly coming from compactifications, or one of the SQs is much larger.
That's right. So it's coming from the guys that live out here in this tail.
So wouldn't that also say that generically you don't get?
Yeah.
You get one. You don't. You can't make both of them microscopic.
That's right. So generically, you expect one of the spheres to be larger than the other sphere. The typical De Sitter vacuum in this landscape has a hierarchy.
Can Can you say anything about, you know, if we want them to be small enough that to satisfy observational constraints? If we impose that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We'll circle back and get that in a few more slides. I'm coming back for that one, though. I promise. Okay, yeah, so as you move to larger values of n, you get more directions in this phase diagram, and you can end up with an infinite volume because you'll end up with a whole circle here like this. This sitter tail will have infinite volume in the rotational direction. And if you increase q, the blue line and the green line will pull away from each other, and there'll be an infinite total volume in the tails there. This plot also might have you a little worried about flux quantization. So the fluxes have to satisfy a quantization argument. So actually, while we've been treating the n as continuous, there are only allowed physical vacua at discrete grid points on this plot. And quantization could affect this argument about having a large number of de Sitter vacua if the allowed vacua straddle this, this tail of de Sitter vacua. So you would have to be tuned exactly so that all of the grid points lie in this thin little tail in order to see this pileup of de Sitter vacua. And indeed, that argument is correct. When you add flux quantization, you'll no longer see an infinite number of de Sitter vacua. That infinity is going to be replaced by a double exponentially large number. And you'll still have the pileup at lambda equals 0. So let's see how that happens. At the n equals 1 level, you have a distribution of vacua that looks like this. This is our old plot, except you're only allowed vacua that live at discrete grid points in an I space. So you have to be one of these blue dots. And there's here the lowest de Sitter descendant, the lowest de Sitter daughter, has a value of the Hubble scale that looks like the maximum allowed Hubble scale in the landscape divided by the total number of de Sitter minima. And then you can take this lowest de Sitter daughter and look at its lowest her lowest de Sitter daughter, and you can iterate that process n times. So here we haven't done any, you could imagine tuning G so that this lowest de Sitter daughter happens to be very close to Minkowski, but let's just take the grid spacing as never ever getting lucky in that way. So you're generically a half a grid spacing away from the Minkowski. So after n generations, the smallest daughter of the smallest daughter of the smallest daughter goes like this. So its value of the Hubble scale is double exponentially small in n. This is hd squared to the 1 plus q over 2 to the n. So as you take n to be large, you can get hd minus q to be very small. And this is setting the spacing of vacua near lambda equals 0. So it's telling you that you have a double exponentially large number of de Sitter vacua, and their cosmological constants are piling up double exponentially near lambda equals 0. OK, so what this means is that.
So could you tell what is the number that you need to get the value that you have
today?
I'm guessing you assume HD is Planckian, or what do you assume for the?
Yeah, so you need lambda d to be sub-Planckian, but not without too much fine-tuning, 10 to the minus 100 times lambda. Otherwise, you're just backed up again. Like, all of these energy densities are automatically Planckian.
I mean, I'm just saying that because there are upper limits on n and q, because I suppose in a string theory you have 11 or 10 dimensions, right? So you cannot have two. They cannot get too big, right?
That's right. If you want to embed this in string theory, in critical string theory, there's a limit on n and q, so that you don't back up against 11 or 12 if you have F theory.
There are also
string theory constructions of higher dimensional de Sitter space in non-critical string theory. Mm-hmm. So there's no cap on n.
So for critical string theory, do you think is it possible to do it? I mean, those numbers, do they work out to get 10 to the minus 20? 10 to the minus 120?
No, they don't.
Okay, they don't.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Can I explain this, your conclusion? Because that's an important thing too, I guess.
that.
No, that's right. So for if you don't want a number of extra dimensions to be bigger than 6, then you can take n equals 2, q equals 3, or n equals 3, q equals 2, which without flux quantization, those are the first cases where you have an infinite number of de Sitter vacua. But if you take flux quantization and you don't tune that quantization to be small, then you're just starting to see this infinity vacua. Okay, so the typical de Sitter vacuum in this landscape, therefore, has a double exponentially small cosmological constant. And another way to say it is the cosmological constant problem is solved. Typical vacua in this landscape just naturally have small cosmological constants. But instead, they have a different problem, which is actually no less severe. And that's that the size of the extra dimensions is typically very large for these de Sitter vacua. Generically, it's double exponentially large. In fact, the KK scale is typically of order the Hubble scale for these vacua. So typical vacua have a Hubble scale that's roughly MKK, and it's roughly given by exactly one step up in the sequential compactification. So it's set by the Hubble scale of their direct parent. So HP is roughly MKK, is roughly HP plus Q. So while this landscape has no cosmological constant problem, it has a different problem. It has a size of the extra dimensions problem that is exactly as tuned as before. However, there are rarer vacua for which MKK is higher. So one thing you could do is you could restrict attention to vacua where HP is considerably smaller than MKK.
I mean, that's 10 to the minus 15?
Yes, that's 10 to the minus 50. That's right, sorry. So I got 10 to the minus 50 as the number that it would take to push the KK scale above 1 to EV. So in particular, you can focus on those vacua for which MKK, there's an unnatural tuned hierarchy of MKK considerably larger than HP. And there's actually still a double exponentially large number of them, and their cosmological constants still accumulate at H equals 0. And the way to see that is like, these are the vacua that just happened to have gotten lucky at the very last step and ended up with an HP that's unnaturally closer to Minkowski than it should have been. So they're suppressed by 10 to the minus 50, so you're multiplying an exponentially small number by a double exponentially large number. So if you're starting with a number of de Sitter vacua in the landscape that's considerably larger than 10 to the 50, then you expect to still have this pileup of vacua. A second thing you could do, though, is you could restrict to vacua for which this MKK is no bigger than So here we're comparing MKK to HP, and we're focusing on vacua that have a hierarchy there. And we're measuring largeness of MKK in that way. But instead, you could measure largeness of MKK with respect to a four-dimensional energy scale like 1 to EV, something that's relevant to a four-dimensional effective field theorist. And that's effectively putting a maximum size on the extra dimensions, and that's cutting off the de Sitter tails. So if you restrict to vacua for which MKK is bigger than 1 to EV, then this accumulation point will be obliterated. Okay, I'm gonna now move on to part 3. But this is kind of changing gears, so if there are any questions, let's maybe do them now.
This is not really important or anything, but you could save yourself a 10 to the 50 number, because you don't have to put it up to 10 TV or 1 TV. You could put it up as far as, we could all live in a brain or something in that world, and then the bounds would be weaker, right? So you'd have a smaller number?
That's right, yeah. So in these large extra dimensions things, you could ask if we live on a brain.
It's right. Still going to be a 10 to the big number, but it won't be 50.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but definitely these guys where the typical de Sitter vacuum here, HP was double exponentially small, but MKK was, so it's something like 10 to the 26 meters is the typical size of the extra dimensions here. And that, even if you live on a brain, is ruled out.
But did you say that critical string theory doesn't work because Q and N aren't big enough? Or didn't you say that?
Well, so your double exponential is, it's something like hd to the q to the n.
Okay.
And there's also a 1 over g to the something to the something. So n is in a double exponentially large power, but n is capped at 2 or 3. So if you could tune g to be small, and then
okay.
you could get this number of De Sitter vacua to be very large.
So you think that's just by tuning g, you can just make this big.
Even that's right. But even for the n equals 1 guy, where the number of vacua is linear in g inverse, you could tune g to be small and get the number of vacua in the landscape to be
but
very
is
large.
That tuning of g technically natural? Because like, you're saying there's no problem, there's no cosmological constant problems on one of your slides. So if you're making an adjustment to get a lot of solutions, is that choice natural?
I think probably not. I think G has corrections.
What was G?
Oh, G is the spacing between the vacua.
What sets it? I mean, but is there a fundamental constant, a Kaplan constant that sets that? Or
it's set by fundamental. I mean, it's related by a direct quantization argument to the fundamental electric charge.
It must basically be the gauge coupling of the flux, right?
Right.
So you want that to be small compared to the Planck scale on the top.
That's right. Well, certainly you want it. I mean,
this is
in the magnetic sector. It's
when the gauge coupling is small.
Well, that's the electric coupling is small. Yeah.
Yeah. So the magnetic one is large when the electric is small.
And vice versa.
But you need it to be small.
What do you need? Yeah.
If you want, this is for the n equals one guy. Where you have to tune g to be, you have to tune the spacing to be very small in order to fill out a large number of vacua.
But does that correspond to the gauge coupling in the Lagrangian is large or small?
There's the magnetic coupling and the electric coupling are related to each other by a 1 over.
So let's just talk about the electric coupling.
Okay, so this is the magnetic coupling g that I'm talking about.
Right, I know that that's the one.
If you want it to be small, you want the electric coupling e to be large.
So but then the whole semi-classical analysis is kind
of given the whole theory that's
I think it is not a good idea to take this n equals 1 model and tune the number of vacua to be large. So if you take larger values of n, you're getting this pileup that's double exponential in g. So you only need g to be a little bit smaller than 1, like 0.1. And then because you're double exponential in it, that will very quickly make the number of vacua very large.
But is that choice, is choosing that number to be 0.1 correspond to choosing the electric coupling to be larger than the gravitational coupling?
No, presumably.
Because those are the scales in the problem, right? It's basically those two scales.
That's right.
It's important to pin down because once that coupling, once the electric coupling is bigger than the gravitational coupling, then the loop expansion is coupled again.
Yeah, that's true. Let's see. There's also a factor of the volume of the internal manifold when you make this direct quantization argument. I have a feeling there's room for both of these couplings to be smaller than the gravitational coupling. That sounds right, but I'm not sure. Let me.
Then how can you have describe a theory simultaneously with small magnetic couplings and small electric couplings?
Oh no, I want them both to be roughly the same and subplankian.
Then the whole theory is not the same. They're the same. Electric and magnetic coupling. And the whole point is either one or the other, you kind of both preservative.
Can we maybe move?
Sure.
We want G to be the magnetic coupling, and it wants to be subplane, but not tuned to be very, very small. Okay, so now let's look at what happens to the shape modes of these spheres. So we've so far been treating the radii as dynamical, but we've been freezing them in exactly spherical in shape. So what happens if you let these shape modes fluctuate? A first guess would be that it's like banging a drum or plucking a string, that the higher mode fluctuations have a higher mass and make a higher sound. So if you've stabilized the L equals 0 mode, the radius, you've automatically stabilized all the higher modes. However, it turns out that that intuition is too naive, and it's too naive because of coupling between the modes. And so when modes couple, you have to diagonalize, and that diagonalization can introduce an unstable mass square. So a simple example to keep in mind here is the Jeans instability. When you hold fixed the density of the plasma and just fluctuate the gravitons, that has a positive mass. If you hold fixed the gravitational background and fluctuate the density of the plasma, that also has a positive mass. But if you couple these modes together, there'll be a mode where an overdensity forms and that gravitates more, and then things will fall into that. That'll be an instability. So that's what we're going to see here. So let's start with the n equals 1 case. The n equals 1 case was studied in a pair of papers early in the 2000s, and then it was again restudied by Kurt, as well as Jan Levin and Claire Zukowski. And so the thing they find is that most of the modes, most of the gravitational modes decouple, but there are two modes that you have to worry about that couple, and when you diagonalize them, you can introduce an instability. And so the two modes that you're worried about are the trace of the internal manifold and a scalar from the flux sector. So let's look at what those look like. So the gravity mode, the fluctuations of the trace, can be thought of like this. You can take them and you can decompose them in terms of their spherical harmonics. For L equals 0, it's the radion fluctuation. So the sphere either grows in radius or shrinks in radius. In the L equals 1 sector, it's actually just a gauge fluctuation. That's because if you take a sphere and you shift it by its L equals 1 mode, you end up with a shifted sphere. The sphere doesn't change shape at all, and the induced metric on the shifted sphere is the same. The L equals 2 mode corresponds to taking your sphere and making it either prolate or oblate. And there are also higher L fluctuations where the sphere becomes lumpy in various ways. It's gonna end up being a combination of this and a flux mode that's unstable. So here are what the flux modes look like. You can also take the flux density around the sphere and vary it, and you can decompose those variations in terms of spherical harmonics. So if you try to vary the L equals 0 mode of the flux density, you're cheating. You're changing the number of flux units, which is a conserved quantity. Or you could take the flux density and perturb it by its L equals 1 mode. So that means you slosh the flux over to the left side of the sphere and then over to the right side of the sphere, something like this. You increase the density on one pole and decrease it on the other. Or you can perturb the flux along its L equals 2 mode. You can draw it off to both poles at once and leave the equator with less flux, or you can draw it around the equator. And then there's also higher L modes where it becomes lumpy and so to summarize, in the L equals 1 sector, there's only a single fluctuation. It's the radion fluctuation. It's just the gravity fluctuation. And those are the ones that we studied in the first half of this talk, and we've explicitly stabilized. So let's look at vacua for which that radion is stable. In the L equals 1 sector, there wasn't a gravity perturbation. There was just this flux perturbation, where the flux is sloshing left and sloshing right. And that guy's always massive. He's always stable. And in fact, he's always more stable than the radion. For the L equals 2 and higher, there were two fluctuations. There was a gravity fluctuation, and there was a fluctuation in the flux density. And those guys couple to each other, so you have to diagonalize.
You lost the L equals 1 mode because that's the conformal Hilbert vector, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. So for the L equals 2 and higher, you have a 2x2 coupled system, and you have to diagonalize. And it turns out when you diagonalize, the eigenvectors have roughly equal contributions from both gravity and flux. So the diagonalized pairs will look like this. There'll be a guy where you become prolate, and the flux density increases around the radius, around the equator, around the region where the curvature density has gotten smaller. And there's the guy where the opposite happens, where you become football-shaped and the flux density increases at the tips of the football. And this guy is your danger mode. This is the guy whose mass can sometimes be unstable. So the stability of this danger mode depends on features of the higher Mitchell theory. It depends on the sign of lambda, it depends on the number of units of flux, and it depends on the angular momentum of the mode, L. But first, we should ask just quickly, what does stability mean in this context? You've computed a mass squared. Stability for de Sitter or Minkowski compactifications will mean that the mass squared is positive. But for an ADS compactification, you're allowed a negative mass squared as long as it's not too negative. So the way to think about that is this. If you have a scalar field phi that lives in this unstable potential, minus m squared phi squared, and let's work in flat space just for a second, and let's take a sphere of radius r, and let's hold the radius, let's hold phi equal to zero, everywhere on the outside of this sphere. So phi is held everywhere at the maximum of its potential. If the radius of the sphere is small, then gradient terms dominate, and phi is equal to zero everywhere on the inside of the sphere. It's not worth sloshing off and going down this instability direction because you have to drag yourself back up by the time you get to the other side of the sphere. But when you increase the radius of the sphere, at some critical value of the radius, the instability does appear and the phi field falls off on the inside of the sphere. So in other words, there's some critical value of the surface area to volume ratio at which the instability appears. And in Minkowski space, when you increase the radius of the sphere to infinity, the surface area to volume ratio goes to zero. But in anti-de Sitter space, that's not the case. As you increase the radius of the sphere, the surface area to volume ratio of the sphere is actually bounded from below. And the reason is most of the volume of a sphere in anti-de Sitter space lives one ADS length away from the outside. So volume in other, instead of scaling like r to the d, scales like r to the d minus 1 times L. So volume and surface area scale the same way at large radius. So what this turns into is something called the Brighton-Lerner-Friedman bound, that you're allowed negative mass squares as long as they're not too negative, as long as they're not so negative that if you hold fixed the value at the top of the potential on the out, at infinity in ADS space, that you won't fall off on the inside. Okay, so here's how it works when lambda is equal to zero. When lambda is equal to zero, you find this danger mode, you find its mass as a function of L, and you can plot it. And when you plot it, it looks like this. It comes down, it crosses negative mass squares, it decreases, it hits a minimum, and then it goes back up. And for all larger L's, m squared is increasing as a function of L. This is the regime in which it's behaving like a drum, where m squared is monotonically increasing with L squared. But it has a minimum at L equals q minus 1 over 2. And at that minimum, the mass of the danger mode, the most negative mass squared in your theory, is exactly the BF bound. So there's one guy that exactly saturates the BF bound, and all other fluctuations are positive. So if you start with lambda equals 0, your n equals 1 compactifications are always stable.
So I'm a bit confused. L is an integer, but q minus 1 divided by 2?
That's right. Perfect. This number, q minus 1 over 2, is going to split our problem up into three cases. So there's the case q equals 2 or 3. That's the guy where the minimum of this, this q minus 1 over 2 is happening for L less than 2. And for L less than 2, the L equals 0 mode and the L equals 1 mode, we saw there was some funny business with gauge invariance and flux quantization and flux conservation that kills those modes. So for q equals 2 and q equals 3 are special cases. They have to be treated separately. And then there's also a difference between the Q odd and the Q even cases. If Q is odd, there is a single fluctuation in your theory that lies exactly at the BF bound, and all other guys are stable. And if Q is even, there's no guy at the BF bound. You only live at integer values of L, so there'll be one guy here and one guy here. So all of your modes are above the BF bound. What happens when you take the higher dimensional lambda not equal to zero? So if you take lambda negative, you start with a higher dimensional ADS space, then that takes this curve and it shifts it up. So all of your fluctuations in the theory become more massive. If instead you take lambda and you make it positive, you look at a higher dimensional De Sitter space, that takes this curve and it pushes it beneath the BF bound. So some of your vacua can become unstable. And we can summarize all this in a chart. So for the case of Q equals 2 or Q equals 3, when you've compactified on a 2 or 3 sphere, then no matter what lambda you start with, the solution's always stable. These were the special cases, so you just grind a crank. When Q is odd, so when lambda is less than or equal to 0, all other Qs are stable, so all of these solutions are stable. When lambda is positive, it depends on whether Q is even or odd. If Q is odd, remember there was a guy that was exactly at the BF bound. So if you increase lambda even infinitesimally, so you start with an ADS compactification where the ADS curvature length is very, very small, and the radius of the internal sphere is very, very small, and you turn on a higher dimensional lambda, just infinitesimally, so some giant Hubble scale, you'll still knock all of these solutions out of stability. So when Q is odd and bigger than 4, every single front Rubin compactification is unstable to some L mode perturbation. When Q is even, you have a little bit of room to work with because there was no fluctuation that was exactly at the BF bound. So some of the deep ADS guys are stable, and it's only when either when you increase lambda more or when you pull the guy up further from ADS that you get an instability. OK, so that was previous work. What about these compactifications when n is bigger than or equal to 2? So that was done recently by myself and Adam Brown in a paper. So here, again, you want to focus just on these trace modes and these flux modes. All other perturbations you can show to be positive. And each sphere has its own spherical harmonic L that you need to worry about. So in particular, instead of having 2 by 2 matrices, you'll now have 2n by 2n matrices, these coupled fluctuations that you have to diagonalize. I'm going to spare you every single excruciating detail of this calculation and just tell you the answer. And the answer is this. So again, when Q is equal to 2 or when Q is equal to 3, all of these solutions are stable. So in particular, in the first half of the talk, you should plug in Q equals 2 or Q equals 3 to have a stable solution. However, when Q is 4 or bigger, you start to get instabilities. In fact, you get almost all of these solutions are unstable. And it's not only when the higher dimensional lambda is positive. You also end up with instabilities when the higher dimensional lambda is negative. For more details, you should see.
Sorry, doesn't that was the first column contradicts the Wolf, Gunzer, Horowitz, right? They said for lambda equals 0, they were saying, the sphere has to be at least 9-dimensional for it to be stable.
The Wolf-Gubser result was the n equals 1 table.
Covers n equals 2.
Yeah, so they also looked at the case of a product of spheres. Yeah. So they looked at a case like S2 cross S2. But when they looked at S2 cross S2, they wrapped a 4-form flux around the whole thing. And when you wrap a 4-form flux around it, you have an instability. You have an instability where one of the sphere's radii shrinks and the other radius grows. The reason is the 4-form flux sort of isn't sensitive to these lower curvatures, like these subcurvatures, these 2-curvature terms. So when one of the radii shrinks and the other one grows, the 4 flux can't do anything about it to push the radii back. The case we're looking at, the higher n case, is when you have an S2 cross S2, but you wrap a 2-form flux around each of them.
Okay, so you say it's different.
And wrapping a 2-form flux around each of them explicitly stabilizes this cycle collapse instability that they found.
Okay.
So they would have said that most of these product compactifications, these larger n's with q equals 2 or 3, when you wrap the highest form flux around all of them, they're mostly unstable. But by wrapping lower form flux around these cycles, we've found stable compactified solutions where the internal manifold is a product. And they sometimes have these shape mode instabilities. But when q is equal to 2 or q equals equal to 3, there's just a large number of stable product manifold compactifications we found. OK, let me just end with three sort of disconnected random points. This is my last slide. The first is that the unstable mode can kind of have bizarrely large angular momentum when the internal Q-sphere has a lot of dimensions. So in particular, if you look at an ADS4 cross S101, you start in 105 dimensions and you compactify on 101 sphere, then that guy is stable to all fluctuations except one with L equals 50. So L equals 49 is stable, L equals 51 is stable. There's one random guy up there in the spectrum. And that's bizarre to me.
I mean, the 101 dimension wasn't bizarre to you.
The second is that, so in addition to studying the stability, we've also, in the process, studied the spectrum of all of these compactifications. And for theories, for the ADS vacua, and starting with lambda equals 0, these spectrums should presumably be able to match to some CFT dual. So you don't often read much about ADS-CFT when the internal manifold is a product, I think because of this Busso, DeWolf, Gubser, Mitra, Horowitz cycle collapse instability. But wrapping lower form fluxes around them explicitly stabilizes that. And it should open up some new set of ADS-CFT dualities. And also, you should be able to see this instability we found. So even when lambda is equal to 0, when Q gets big, there's sometimes instability. And the final point is that these compactified vacua also correspond to the near horizon limit of higher dimensional black brains. So the way to see that is sort of with this doodle of what a black hole looks like. If you're very near a black hole, the directions around the event horizon look like a compactified sphere, and the direction away from the black hole combines with the directions along the black brain to make an ADS space. So a lot of these ADS solutions we were looking at are also near horizon limits of black P brains. And the instabilities we found there should translate here. So in particular, this suggests that a handful of higher dimensional P brains, higher dimensional charged P brains in De Sitter space, are unstable to have their horizons become a little lumpy. So to fall off and instead of having spherical horizons, have elliptical horizons. OK, that's it. Yeah?
So the last two points, if you put them together, you know, the near horizon limit in the ADS-CFT story would have been a very low temperature limit. And mm-hmm. It sounds like you would have a class of new instabilities for things as they flow through the far infrared, in the sense that it's being described by your models, and those models have instabilities that people didn't appreciate before.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, that's it. And also, can I, since I invite you,
sure.
So I missed your introductory thing, and so the first part about the distribution of De Sitter spaces. Is it, let me play it back to you to make sure I got it. So my understanding of part of the anthropic argument was that the way Weinberg sells it, for instance, is, mm-hmm. that, is that there's nothing special about zero, and so then you're looking for an argument, and you're using uniform, you know, priors because you're saying that nothing special about zero is the fact that we're dealing with, and you're saying that that basic fact is up for grabs now, that there is something special about zero in these models.
That's right, yeah. But the vacua that treat v equals 0, that treat lambda equals 0 as special, they also have this property that they've got really large extra dimensions. So you might want to treat this as just a reshuffling of the anthropic words you speak.
Well, the way I spin it is that it's a spike, which I'm hoping is a silver spike into the heart of the whole program, because the argument against there being a mechanism that would make a dynamical mechanism to find lambda equals zero, that would have had to make lambda equals zero special.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no evidence for that. And so you're saying that there may be evidence for that.
Certainly.
Not having enough giving a mechanism, but it's that particular observation is not necessarily relevant.
If it's a silver spike, you're the one wielding the hammer there. That's not me with the hammer. Yeah.
So how diagonal is the, I guess it's not very diagonal, the mass matrix for the multiple end case? I mean, so there's some mixing between the modes on the different spheres. You had a really nice physical picture for the n equals 1 case for where the instability was coming from. Do you have a corresponding physical picture for the multiple sphere case?
It's definitely has to do with coupling. Like, here's an argument you think should be right for the same reason that you'd think the drum argument would be right. When you have an extra sphere here, all it's doing is lowering the effective cosmological constant for what's going on here. And lowering lambda should make the solution more stable. So you'd think that going to higher n would just make, you'd get the same plot, as the same graph as before, except everything would be a little bit more stable. But the modes couple between the two different spheres. So the danger mode is a guy where both spheres are becoming curved and all the fluxes are sloshing around too. So there's one danger mode that's just some very coupled, it gets roughly equal contribution from all of the spheres.
Do you know where it goes?
No. So there's a few papers by someone named Kinoshita, who's numerically found some lumpy guys. They'd be like the analog of the lumpy black strings that Gubser found numerically for the Gregory Laflamme instability. It's not known if these lumpy guys are stable. I'd say they're not particularly well understood right now.
Thank you.